secret government documents, Puerto Rico's power problem, and the return of Calle Ocho's icon. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This week, the government was supposed to release papers exposing more information about the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy. Within those documents is information that links Miami to an assassination attempt of the late Fidel Castro. But why did Biden decide to keep the papers secret? Also,
when it got dark, the street lights on the highway were not on, and people were lighting their way with their cell phones.
Puerto Rico is still trying to rebuild its power grid. We'll hear about the growing frustration with rolling blackouts. And finally, Little Havana's club, Ball and Chain, reopening after more than a year. Why their success is important to Calle Ocho. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. The release of documents detailing U.S. government secrets has been delayed again. These hidden reports have information related to the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy, but they also have a South Florida connection. One of the censored files involves the CIA's Miami office and a plot to kill Fidel Castro. They were supposed to be made public this week, but the Biden administration made the decision to continue to keep them secret for now. Well, joining us is Politico senior national correspondent Brian Bender to talk about this. Brian, thank you so much for the time. Something out of a movie, it really is. And a lot of people have been waiting to look at these documents. They were supposed to be made public yesterday. But remind us, why decades later? Why did we have to wait this long?
So this goes back to the 1990s, and you're talking about movies. The movie JFK by Oliver Stone came out in the early 1990s. And in the wake of that, there was a lot of public pressure for the government to reveal what more it might know about the events of November 22nd, 1963. So Congress passed a law, the 1992 JFK Records Act, which created an oversight board, which was tasked with collecting from the CIA and a host of other agencies what files they might still have that might shed light on Kennedy's assassination. It was called the Assassination Records Review Board. They released thousands of files in the 1990s, but they did set aside a fairly significant batch that they were convinced shouldn't be released at the time, but ultimately should be released. And they set October 2017, for the date for when the rest of these files should be released.
And the Trump administration decided not to.
Right. That date came, and President Trump delayed the release for another 3.5 years. And so that's how we got to this week, when President Biden was faced with this new deadline. And as we know, he decided to punt once again. And the argument the administration makes is that it's sort of twofold. Number one, there's still things in these files that need to be shielded to protect intelligence sources and methods. If we just throw that out there, it could harm national security. And they also make a COVID argument. In other words, the process for reviewing these documents for eventual public release has been delayed, slowed down because of the pandemic. So
not that they haven't had enough time to look over those documents, but yeah. So supposedly, you know, these documents are going to shed some more light on the 63 assassination of JFK. You wrote about how public opinion polls show still, I think, most Americans don't believe in the official conclusion on that assassination by the Warren Commission. Remind us of what that conclusion was.
So the official narrative has always been that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine who at one point defected to the Soviet Union and then somehow came back and regained his citizenship, acted alone when he shot President Kennedy from the sixth floor of the school book depository in downtown Dallas, Texas. That was the Warren Commission's official finding about a year after the assassination. But as you point out, there were a lot of holes, so to speak, in the official explanation. And, you know, the public has always doubted it. Certainly scholars, researchers, generations of them now have raised lots of questions. And I think, you know, these files that are still remaining, no one really believes there's a, you know, a file somewhere that's going to finally solve this mystery or set to rest all of the questions. But these files do cover a lot of covert operations, intelligence activities that the U.S. was engaged in at the time, which could have some bearing on the assassination. What do I mean by that? Lee Harvey Oswald, it's public knowledge, was involved with some Cuban exiles, groups that wanted to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba. He can be placed in New Orleans, interacting with some of these individuals. You mentioned Miami is a place where the CIA had a huge propaganda operation going on to try and undermine Fidel Castro. And so Oswald, we know, is connected to some of these Cuban elements. And so when all of these records were collected up in the 1990s, there was this view that what constitutes a JFK assassination record needs to be a very broad definition. So not just, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald and the people he might have known and what he did and what the government might know about that, but what about all these covert operations?
And so
might have been connected to Oswald.
So what if we release that information now that he had those connections, that he had connections with different Cuban groups? What would that hurt now to know about it?
Well, I think the argument that the CIA and other agencies, and most of these remaining records are CIA records, are making is that it's not so much what's in these documents or, you know, the parts of documents that are blacked out, names, places, et cetera. It's the sources and methods, quote unquote. That's the argument they keep making. In other words, if we release this information, it might inform our adversaries how we operate, how our intelligence agencies gather information. What kind of sources do we use?
50 years later that we're still doing this, like the CIA would still be gathering information the same way? Hasn't technology changed? Haven't our methods changed?
Well, that's the overwhelming counterargument, is it's been 58 years. Number one, any sources, individual sources that might have been important back then have to be dead, number one. And even the methods, even if their methods were still using, the idea that nobody knows about these methods, that the Chinese or the Russians or, you know, other countries that were trying to keep this information from don't have any idea how we operate, seems to be a little silly. And so that's the counter argument, which is that, you know, that really doesn't hold up anymore. And it's not just researchers, scholars who want access to these documents that are making those arguments. I just talked to a federal judge, John Tunheim, who ran the Assassination Records Review Board in the 1990s. So this was the federal judge who was in charge of collecting the records and pushing them out into the public. He's the first to say that argument doesn't hold water anymore. This has been six decades. There's nothing in there that's going to harm the United States. It's time to put this stuff out there. He told me he's going to write a letter to the president telling him just that.
Wow. I'm speaking with Brian Bender, senior national correspondent for Politico. We're talking about documents detailing government secrets related to the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy. Those hidden files were supposed to become public yesterday, but the White House has delayed the release. And we're talking about ties to South Florida here. So you can find more about this in his reporting, by the way, and the story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Brian, let's get to that link to Miami, because one of the censored files involves a CIA plot to kill former Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Okay, what do we know about this plot? What was being plotted supposedly here in Miami?
Well, I mean, we certainly know from a lot of other government archives that have become public over the decades that You know, the United States government had a number of plots underway to try and get rid of Fidel Castro, who was seen as a threat, as a puppet of the Soviet Union because he was a communist. And so it's not new that we were trying to overthrow Castro. I think that's very well known. It's the devil in the details, so to speak. There are still some files in this JFK collection, as you mentioned, about the Miami CIA station, what their role was, what they were doing. That's something the CIA has resisted for years releasing. There are other files about similar activities in New Orleans. And as I mentioned earlier, Lee Harvey Oswald, who is fingered as the assassin of the president, had ties with some Cuban groups in New Orleans. He was physically there in the summer of 1963. And so, again, the connection here to the assassination is this whole sort of web of secret U.S. covert operations, much of them focused on Cuba, that were taking place at the time, that we have not seen everything the U.S. government knows or was doing at the time, and whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald popped into the view of the CIA, of the FBI, of others around that time. And that really is what this is about. It's not, and Judge Tunheim, who oversaw the collection of all these records, said, very few people expect there to be something in these files that's going to be, aha, we now know what happened to John F. Kennedy.
Right, right.
More the bigger picture, the stage, if you will, on which this took place, which does raise questions about what the U.S. government knew about Lee Harvey Oswald. And in my mind, even more so raises questions about the extent to which the U.S. government went to prevent a full investigation of President Kennedy's murder.
And the other thing, too, that you bring up is, and we kind of knew this, too, is the mafia's involvement in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, the mafia, we know, again, from other government records, was enlisted by the CIA to try and overthrow Castro in Cuba. The mafia had a lot of illegal activities going on in Cuba prior to 1959 when Castro took over, the casinos, the gambling, et cetera. They wanted back into Cuba. They wanted Castro out of there. And so we do know the CIA and the mafia were in bed trying to overthrow Castro. And then we also know that Lee Harvey Oswald was shot to death in the Dallas police station 3 days after the assassination by Jack Ruby, a nightclub owner in Dallas with, you know, endless ties to the mafia.
Right. The other thing, too, is the White House had announced the delay, and two of the nephews, JFK's nephews, spoke up, and they're calling on Biden, release the documents.
Yeah, I mean, most people who have followed this, government officials and others, all agree that, you know, it's well past time to do this. And I think Kennedy's family or members of his family obviously have a unique voice in all of this. But yes, two nephews who say, you know, it's time to put this out there. Democracies don't do this. We don't shield this kind of stuff all these years later. And so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Biden did put in place a process to continue reviewing these documents and with the hope of releasing some by the end of this year, more perhaps a year plus from now. But the CIA can still come back to the president and say, we want to keep this hidden, or we don't want to release that. And if they can convince the president, there's really no other recourse. The buck does stop at the White House when it comes to classified information. And Biden could either overrule them, or he could say, you know, okay, let's delay this further.
So it could be a year, a couple of years, and we don't know, you know, again, depending on what the president wants to do. You know, who's fighting this right now? Who is anyone fighting, you know, the delay, wants to see them? Because we just talked about JFK's nephews and one judge you had mentioned, but anyone ready to actually, like, take this to court and fight this?
Well, there have been a lot of court cases over the years over these documents, sort of a mixed record of how that's played out. You know, there's a whole community, a coalition of researchers, scholars, academics who want access to these files. Some of them want access not because they necessarily are studying the assassination. They might be studying U.S.-Cuban relations. There's a whole set of scholars out there that want access to these. A group of them has filed a new lawsuit this week. I think it was Monday. And what they're seeking actually is the underlying communications, the letters, the emails back and forth between Presidents Trump and Biden and the CIA and other agencies over why to keep these documents secret. In other words, what were the arguments the CIA made as to why we still need to hold on to this? It'll be interesting to see if they get anything.
That or somebody's making another movie and they just love the documents. But this is a fascinating story. It really absolutely is. And I guess we're just going to have to sit back and wait. At some point, maybe, just maybe, those documents will be released. Brian Bender, senior national correspondent for Politico. Check out his story on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It does sound like a Miami story, doesn't it? Miami CIA office, Fidel Castro, Lee Harvey Oswald. There's a Netflix series and all of that. Still to come, years after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico is still struggling to keep the lights on. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Hundreds of thousands of people on the island of Puerto Rico are living with constant power outages and rolling blackouts. Hurricane Maria back in 2017 showed us the vulnerability and the weakness of the island's electrical grid. This past summer, they brought in a private entity to help improve the power grid, but not much has improved, and people are protesting. Patty Mazet covers Puerto Rico for the New York Times, and we spoke with her this morning to learn more about life on the island still trying to rebuild its power grid. How many power outages, how many rolling blackouts are we talking about over the last few months? Is it something that's regular or sporadic?
There's honestly too many to count. That's what the Puerto Ricans who have testified recently before a congressional committee have said. Some of them are very short. Sometimes it's a flickering of power. Sometimes it's a surge. Sometimes it's that the power is not coming in, you know, as it should. And so you don't even notice it until sort of your appliances get fried. Other times there have been huge outages where, you know, more than half of the 1.5 million power customers have lost their power at once. And in August and September, there were actually like rolling blackouts that were sort of like people were notified that there were going to be some because the demand in power goes up, you know, in the really hot months of the year when everybody wants to turn on their air conditioning. And so those would sort of just hit, you know, at any time. For example, when I was in the island 2 weeks ago, I was at a bakery, you know, buying coffee and breakfast, and the power went out right before I went to pay. And so there's like this group groan of like resignation when everyone's like, oh, you know, like not again. And then, you know, their generator kicked in. But that's the sort of thing that people have become accustomed to, unfortunately.
And when you were there and you were experiencing that, how long did that blackout last?
It was very brief, as far as I could tell. I went back on the road and, you know, they were on their generator. So it was not one of those where like the whole city goes dark, but there, you know, are intermittent problems that sort of flare up when, you know, when you least expect it. It's not like, you know, your power is going to go out at 5 p.m. on a given day.
So wasn't it this past summer that a different group took over the island's power system, right?
Yes. In June, a private consortium took over the transmission and distribution of power. So essentially the power grid, the generation of electricity is still controlled by the public utility. That's the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, which is known as PREPA and is one of the two largest public electric utilities in the United States. And the new consortium is an American-Canadian group known as LUMA Energy.
And what is LUMA bringing? What are they doing?
As you know, Puerto Rico is in a sort of bankruptcy and has their finances overseen by a fiscal board that was appointed by Congress. And their thinking was that privatizing the transmission and distribution of power would effectively give Puerto Ricans better service at a better cost. They pay an awful lot for electricity on the island because it is an old, outdated system that is pretty inefficient. It still operates on fossil fuels. So that was the reasoning that the fiscal board and the government of Puerto Rico gave for doing this privatization. And what LUMA Energy has been tasked with doing is basically helping put out these projects for bid to improve the power system, because Congress allocated nearly $10 billion to modernize the grid and restore it to its sort of pre-Hurricane Maria levels. And that hasn't been done yet. LUMA is going to help sort of put these projects out and organize them so that the system improves.
And, you know, you talk about how many people have been affected. You know, is the, just as a reminder, I mean, is the whole island on the same system?
Yeah, so the what the hurricane did, if you recall, was knock out the power across the island because the storm was so bad. There was no sort of respite anywhere on Puerto Rico. The biggest power plants are in the southern part of the island, but they generate power for everywhere else. And the grid was left in tatters. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers spent $3 billion trying to put it back together just so people could get their power restored after Maria in 2017. It took them nearly a year to get everybody back. And some of the fixes that were made back then are still in place now. We're talking about, and this is something that the CEO of LUMA Energy told me, there are still some power lines that instead of being hooked up to poles are hooked up to palm trees, because that was the best that they could do when they were trying to patch up the system. So those are the sorts of improvements that have to be done for the long run, because it's not really sustainable to have power lines tied to trees, you can imagine.
I'm trying to picture this. I'm literally trying to picture power lines tied to palm trees.
Oh, and Puerto Ricans will tell you about it, that in their town there is still, you know, power line X tied up to a tree. It's not just something that LUMA says by way of explaining why, you know, the work that they're doing is going to take a long time. Puerto Ricans sort of know that the system is this sort of very frail patchwork. In fact, when LUMA took over in June, they said they were prepared to deal with up to a Category 2 storm. And as you and I know, you know, the categories go up to 5. So there was some concern that if there's going to be a big storm, there was going to be problems. And luckily, Puerto Rico has not been hit by any hurricanes this year. But there are some analysts who are critics of LUMA who say, forget a Category 2. If there's a strong tropical storm that goes through the island, half of the people are going to be without power because the system is that fragile right now.
So with these blackouts, these power outages, it's led to protests. What kind of protests? How big do they get?
There have been some smaller ones. There was one a few weeks ago in front of the governor's mansion in Old San Juan. That was a few hundred people that were there for many hours, and they were very vocal, and there was drums and singing and chanting. There was one a couple of weeks ago that was bigger that shut down the highway. That's not something that had happened in Puerto Rico for a couple of years. Last time it happened was when they had those big protests in 2019 that eventually forced the then governor to resign. So it was a pretty big deal when they were able to shut down the highway, because that means they basically brought out not just sort of a few hundred dedicated people, but regular folks who maybe don't normally take to the streets, but who are very upset about the power. It was a pretty dramatic scene, actually, because they started the protest like at 5 p.m. So they were out there during the sunset. And then when it got dark, the street lights on the highway were not on, and people were lighting their way with their cell phones, which was pretty symbolic, right, of the darkness that they've experienced. And many of their chants, in addition to being against LUMA and demanding that the LUMA Energy contract be canceled, they were saying, you know, I'm spending all my money on fixing my refrigerator, right? Because their appliances, as I mentioned earlier, keep getting fried by these power surges.
We're talking with Patty Mazzei, reporter for the New York Times, talking about the series of rolling blackouts and power outages in Puerto Rico as they struggle to improve their infrastructure years after Hurricane Maria. You can find a link to Patty's story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. What are government officials saying about the protests, but the blackouts and just trying to get the infrastructure right?
Nobody thinks that this is the way it should be, and everybody is upset about it. The government of Puerto Rico still says that LUMA should be equipped to improve this over time and that it's going to take a while because, as Luma has said, this system has a long road ahead of it. You know, the CEO was saying that this is the worst, you know, was the worst utility long before Hurricane Maria and Irma hit in 2017, and it still is, and that there's just a lot of work to be done. You know, Congress allocated those $10 billion for the long-term improvements, but they are only just now starting to bid that money out. So like in the last couple of weeks, there was a project put out for $7 million, which is very little of that pot. But I think people forget how slow it is, or how slow it has been in this particular case, to go from, hey, we're going to give you $10 billion to fix your system, to actually getting crews on the ground fixing the system.
And I wonder if the folks from LUMA have said anything about like timetables. Do they think within 3, 4, 5 years we can get this done?
Right now, they are working on 65 projects to put out to bid that they hope will be put out in the sort of the first half of 2022, and then start getting shovels in the ground sometime next year. So that, you know, and that's just the first 65 projects of many more to come. So this is a, you know, 15-year contract that Puerto Rico gave LUMA to try to deal with this, just to give you an idea of how long it's going to take to spend that money.
And you point out in your story too, that, I mean, yeah, it's inconvenient, you know, as you said, when you were getting your breakfast and the power goes out and everybody just goes, it's a pain in the neck. But you point out it could be dangerous for some people. They need that power for medicine.
Absolutely. There are a lot of diabetics in Puerto Rico who rely on their insulin, which needs to be refrigerated. With the COVID pandemic, there are some people who have, you know, oxygen and other respiratory therapies at home that also require electricity. In the heat, it's very dangerous to be, especially if you're an elderly person, to be overheated without air conditioning in the, you know, the dead of summer. And as we know, after Maria, a lot of the deaths that followed that were sort of indirect deaths from the storm had to do with people not having power. Now, hospitals and other places like that have since, you know, gotten generators and are not, we're not seeing sort of like a system-wide failure, but on the individual level, it can be very dangerous. And it's also scary for people, especially if you live alone and you're in the dark to not have power. In addition to the fact that it affects Puerto Rico's economy, businesses don't necessarily want to grow or invest in a place where they're not guaranteed electricity, internet. People who are still working or studying from home because of the pandemic have those studies and that work interrupted. We interviewed one lady who is trying to get her bachelor's degree online, and you know, her classes keep getting interrupted by these power outages. So it becomes a health issue and a safety issue and also an economic development issue for an island that, as I said, has been in bankruptcy and has had a recession for many years. And so it sort of becomes a compounding problem.
And it's an island. There's a lot of sun, and I'm wondering why solar power isn't discussed more, or is it maybe, and we're just not talking about it right now?
So LUMA says that they came in and there was a 2-year backlog of solar power applications that PREPA had not gotten through, the public power utility, and that they have gotten through half of those and hope to get through the remaining half by the end of the year. But critics of the way Puerto Rico handles its electrical power say that they really have to move much more quickly and forcefully on renewable energy. There is a group that has been pushing for solar power ever since Maria that has drawn out a plan about how to do it, because the issue is not just installing solar panels on people's roofs, but also providing them with batteries so that they can store that power for, you know, the nighttime when there's no sun out. And they think that, you know, they argue in their plan that this would actually be much more cost efficient for the island. LUMA says that it wants to do more renewable energy, but as its critics point out, there is nothing in the contract that was signed with the island and LUMA that requires them to meet certain benchmarks on renewable energy, on cost savings, or anything like that. So we don't actually know to the extent that they're going to pursue these renewable power options. And there's a lot of people in Puerto Rico who are sort of taking matters into their own hands. You know, I interviewed someone for the story, a professor who has been pushing for solar energy, who says eventually people are just going to do this, whether the government wants to or not, because they don't trust the system. And so fewer and fewer people are going to be customers of the power utility because they're going to have their own solar power. And that's going to make electricity more expensive for everybody else who is still on the system. And so it's going to become a problem because there is no sort of like greater global plan to move people towards solar or other sort of renewable energies.
You know, you've been covering Puerto Rico for the New York Times, and I've talked to you so many times about, you know, how the island has tried to recover since Maria. And, you know, you, as you said, you were there not too long ago. How is the island doing? Years now since the storm passed, a few years. Has it recovered? I don't know. What do you experience when you go there?
You know, there's definitely a before and after with a storm like this in Puerto Rico or anywhere where so many things become. It was like this before Maria and it's this way now, or ever since Maria, this, you know, XYZ has changed. I think what is easy to forget, but we should remember with Puerto Rico is part of the reason why Maria was such a big problem was because the government of Puerto Rico did not have money to deal with recovery. And it has been reliant on Congress because it's in this bankruptcy. And so it's not just that there was a really terrible storm. It was that there was a really terrible storm at a time when the government was already struggling to make ends meet. So there is that sort of underlying issue underneath the other issues. And Puerto Rico is still trying to sort of resolve its bankruptcy and have a plan to move forward with its creditors so that it's no longer facing this fiscal oversight board. And that to me is what you still see. It's not so much that you see the remnants of Maria on a day-to-day basis, although certainly if you go to certain parts of the island, you will still see some places that were damaged by the storm that never recovered, you know, buildings on the coast that were swept away that are still sort of there empty, you know, but it's more that the bankruptcy keeps being this issue that is threatening people's pensions, that is cutting the funds to the University of Puerto Rico, that keeps, you know, the island from being able to move forward in a significant way, not because of the storm, but because there is still sort of a lack of money to do things. So to me, the bankruptcy is like the bigger underlying issue. Certainly if you look around, you know, and this relates to the power grid, I think people forget just how green Puerto Rico is in terms of its vegetation. It just got so many trees and plants. And one of the issues with the power grid is that this grows on the trees and the vines and that they grow on the grid. And so you need to be like cutting it back all the time. And that still looks, you know, now like it did pre-Maria, which means that there's just a lot of vegetation to get through. So I would say it's not that the island hasn't recovered from the storm. That is the most obvious thing. It's that the bankruptcy is still affecting sort of day-to-day life and the economy of the island in many significant ways.
That was Patty Mazzei covering Puerto Rico for the New York Times, and you can find a link to her story about the power outages. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And by the way, you know, I mean, if you have family in Puerto Rico, you're from Puerto Rico, or any of the islands of the Caribbean, the Bahamas, Haiti, Jamaica, Dominican Republic, Cuba, we'd always love to hear from you. Tell us what you hear about what's going on back at home, you know, with the islands, with the governments, social issues, et cetera. We always love to hear the stories because we want to talk about those stories. And one of the ways you can do it is just join the Sundial Text Club. It's very easy. Just text us the word hello to 786-677-0767. That's 786-677-0767. And that way you can always just share your thoughts and say, hey, Lewis, there's a story you guys need to be looking at now. Well, still to come, Ball and Chain, one of the hottest clubs in Little Havana, is reopening soon, but not without some challenges. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Miami's nightlife scene is having a steady revival as clubs and bars are welcoming customers back again. And this includes Little Havana's Ball and Chain. After being shut down for over a year, the iconic club is finally reopening. Its owners hope to bring Calle Ocho back to life, but they've had to overcome some challenges. The city of Miami closed the club after finding several code deficiencies, and its entire staff, well, they found other jobs. Miami Herald food editor Carlos Frias joins us now to talk about what this reopening means for its owners, for Little Havana, and of course for Miami. Carlos, great to have you back.
Hey, Louie, good to be here, man.
All right, so people who are not familiar with Little Havana, just remind them of what makes Ball and Chain so special.
Well, Little Havana, you know, back in the day really got its start with, as a kind of like an affordable area where, you know, Cubans moved into over the decades. And it was always kind of like a beat up kind of area. And then it had like a resurgence because there was investment, especially in this stretch between about 12th Avenue and 27th Avenue, just kind of revitalizing the buildings, bringing back kind of like the character of the area, right? You know, polishing it up in some ways, but really more than anything, preserving a bit of culture. And Ball and Chain was one of those, you know, it's like a club slash also restaurant. You know, they also serve food. That kind of led this revival. You know, they took a building that was established, you know, that had some history as an original nightclub from like the 30s, and infused new life and energy. And now it's become really one of the best known tourist spots in Miami-Dade County.
You know, I pass by it every day on the way to work. And what's interesting, and I mean, I know that's in the morning, but I've driven by it at different times of different days. And that one little area around the club just seems like this dead zone to me. I mean, how important is it for it to reopen and what it's going to mean for that one, even that one block?
I mean, it was pretty clear that when that club is open, that stretch of Little Havana is bustling. I mean, like the double-decker red buses are coming down the street. It definitely was the heart of that revitalization. I mean, since COVID, it's been generally closed since about, you know, March of 2020. You've had, you know, one of the most iconic restaurants across the street, El Esquisito, which is a Cuban spot. That place closed down. You know, a lot of the livelihood of that area closed down. Like you said, you walk by that stretch of the street and it looks like this abandoned shell of its former self, you know. And it's so I think it being, you know, azúcar, the Latin flavored and, you know, ice cream slash gelato place next door, they complained that you know, their business was way down just because you didn't have, you know, that draw of people coming in there. So I think that section of Little Havana really missed, has missed Ball and Chain as far as livelihood.
Yeah, they're probably excited to see this come back. You know, the other thing is this: why Ball and Chain was closed for so long? Lots of clubs and bars have reopened. They've been reopened for a long time. It's got some history with the city, doesn't it?
You know, this is a big he said, she said, okay? And a lot of it is, you have one of the most divisive figures in Miami politics at the center of it. That's the Commissioner Joe Carollo. When he was running for office, he believes that among other things, the owners of the company that owned that club, the club owners themselves and the owners of the larger company, backed his opponent. And they believe that he's taken, he's exacting political revenge on them. He's using his stature to exact revenge on them for being, you know, pushing to be against his election. So that has led to a series of things like, you know, the city saying that there were more than 40 deficiencies at the club, and eventually forcing it to close. And the club saying, no, these, you know, some, if not all of these things were made up. And so that's led to legal battles. Like, there's a federal court case specifically that the owners of Ball and Chain have filed against Joe Carollo, and that's working its way through the system now.
Carollo, and we've invited him on the show, by the way. Still, the invitation's open, Commissioner. Would love to have you. But, you know, it's what power does he have? He's one commissioner.
I mean, this is almost a better question for my colleague, Joey Fletches, who's our City of Miami reporter. But the truth is, Joe Carollo is a person who's been in Miami politics since the 80s and certainly controversial. You know, I mean, really one of the first people to use an us versus them mentality to get himself elected. Us versus them, meaning us Cubans against the world. You know, vote Cubans, vote for Cubans. You know, he and Xavier Suarez, the former mayor of Miami, the father of the current mayor, you know, also ran on that policy and us versus them. And so like a very old school kind of militant political way of operating, you know, and he's managed to remain in some way in Miami politics and South Florida government for the last 40 years.
So to make sure, so the owners of Ball and Chain, they're suing the city officials, including Joe Carollo. I believe one lawsuit is for $2.5 million, but there's also a separate lawsuit against the city of Miami for almost $28 million, right?
Yeah, that's a separate lawsuit that was filed in the last month or so against the city. And again, the owners of that club contend that they've been unfairly targeted for closing, and it's, you know, and it's cost them business. And what it's cost for that section of Miami-Dade County, that Little Havana, you know, which Commissioner Carollo has always said that he's a champion for, because he wants to, quote, preserve the feel of it. And these guys are saying, we also want to preserve the feel of it, which is why instead of gutting and leveling the buildings we bought, we've renovated them and made them look original, you know, like reflecting their original purpose. So it's two sides that claim that they're both trying to do the right thing, but apparently can't agree on what the right thing is. And that, I think, has to do more with behind the scene politics than it has anything really about anyone thinking about anybody in Miami or the consumer, you know?
And one of the things you'll always see on Twitter, hashtag because Miami. We're speaking all the time. We're speaking with Miami Herald food editor Carlos Frias about the much anticipated reopening of Little Havana's Ball and Chain nightclub, closed for more than a year, the city said, because of code violations. And again, as we mentioned, there are a couple lawsuits towards the city and city officials for what they say is harassment. You can find out more about this story. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, so Carlos, you know, Ball and Chain now reopening, but there's some challenges. I mean, a lot of the restaurants and bars faced these challenges when they were coming back from the pandemic, but they had the head start because they've been open for months now. What's going to be the biggest challenge for Ball and Chain as they reopen?
The number one challenge is people, is finding the people to work, their staff, to staff up their place, because there's been a sea change in hospitality right now. And the sea change is primarily about money. You have to pay people a significant salary, a significant amount of money that is, you know, let those $10 and $15 an hour salaries are not enough to bring in people who are dedicated to a career in hospitality anymore. And I think that the pandemic has forced the issue. People aren't willing to come and put their health and safety at risk for a job that's paying minimum wage. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for them is finding staff.
Have you seen that around Miami? We've talked about this before. I mean, restaurants and the hospitality industry having to pay more, give more incentives, the signing bonuses. Are they still doing that, or are they still having a hard time finding people?
No, definitely money talks, man. The people who are willing to pay top salaries are bringing in the top talent. I'll give you a perfect example. David Grutman, who's traditionally owned nightclubs, has in the last few years started into the business of restaurants, or as I like to call them, clubsterants, right? Like this mixture of club restaurant. And he's been able to attract great staff. How? Because he's paying at the top of the market. Like I've heard from restaurateurs that smaller restaurateurs that want to, you know, hire a chef or a sous chef or a line person, and they're getting them plucked by Dave Grutman's, club restaurants like Swan and the newest one that he opened. I can't think of in North Bay Village.
Well, wait a minute. What is he paying? What is he giving that he's able to steal people?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't talked specifically with folks who've taken that job, but recently he hired Hedy Goldsmith, who's really one of the great pastry chefs in all of South Florida. Like she's, you know, a person who's been nominated for all the kind of awards and makes these wonderful decadent desserts she had for years. And Michael's Genuine. And every time he has new hire, it's one of these big names. So what I'm getting at is, if you want to bring in those people that have a long track record, it just requires paying them not just competitively, but like at the top of their game.
And when Ball and Chain reopens, I mean, are we talking about they're going back to what they were, or do they have to adjust and adapt as well?
I mean, I think they're going to have to adjust and adapt in the sense that, you know, the pandemic isn't 100% behind us. You know, like they're still going to have to figure out how to run a club, how to run a music venue, because eventually they are going to have music there. They expect to have music there by the time they open again, both inside and outside. They're going to have, you know, they run food and concessions and mixed drinks. So I think that they're, like you said, they're a little bit behind other places that have already reopened. But, you know, maybe they'll learn from that. Maybe they watch what other people have done successfully.
You know, I want to come back briefly to, you know, what you said. They're suing because they claim that the city and certain city officials like Joe Correa have harassed them over code violations. What sort of code violations did the city say Ball and Chain was breaking?
They have a host of violations, things from like, you know, things that they noted, like from the doors of the women's bathroom swinging the wrong way to some issue with the fire suppression systems, like the, you know, sprinkler systems, for a lack of a, you know, as layman's terms. So they're saying they found all these things, and the Ball and Chain owners are saying, no, not, you know, I think admitting that there are some things that they needed to fix there, but that maybe things were being pushed too much in the other direction. And, you know, really what it comes down to is I think that there's just underlying issues between those folks, like between, like I said, it's always political when it comes to dealing with businesses and politics and money in Miami.
Yeah. All right. When is it supposed to reopen? When can people get back in?
They said that, you know, it would be in a couple of weeks. So that would put them kind of in here in November, in the next couple of weeks. So I think that, and they feel like they have some other, a couple outstanding permits that they needed to clear away so that they could start hosting music acts in that big pineapple stage that they have in the back there. But I think that, they're supposed to open in the next couple of weeks. So I guess we'll be seeing how that affects the area.
And that is something a lot of people have been waiting for, the pineapple stage to reopen and get music back up there again. So just being able to sit there and enjoy it, or maybe do a little dancing. I know they used to have also classes. They would actually teach a little bit of salsa. I thought, you know, something that I definitely could use. Still waiting for my
Oh, man. Oh, I want to see that. Let's do a live stream on that.
Oh, let's not. Let's not. I'll tell you guys how it goes. You know, before I let you go, though, Carlos, I mean, you know, because we talked last time about really just how the hospitality industry in general is doing. And it seems, again, like, you know, unemployment is slowly dropping, but we also keep hearing about people just quitting their jobs and because they're tired of how they're being treated. And of course, a big part of that is the hospitality industry. And what are you seeing? What are you hearing? Are people, is it all right? Is it doing all right? Or is there still a struggle?
Well, I've talked to a couple of restaurant owners who, like, low key, they say, you know what, we're doing incredible business. Like I was talking with the owner of a little local wine shop here, Happy Wine, here on Cayocha, which is also on Cayocha, but further west, who he's saying, you know, he's like, I almost feel embarrassed to say, he's like, but, you know, we went through a bad stretch here. We needed PPP loans, but like we're full every day. Like people have responded like, really like a slingshot, you know, they've really come back. So I think we're seeing more of that. And before I forget, I actually got a note from one of the Ball and Chain people just now as we were on the radio, and they said that the Ball and Chain does not have a suit against Joe Carollo. That is the owners of the Barlington Group, which is a little bit splitting hairs because one of the owners of the Barlington Group is an owner in Ball and Chain. But I wanted to make that clear, and that the federal lawsuit filed is only by the owners of Ball and Chain.
Thank you for clarifying that for us. Thank you. You know, make sure you get the information right. And again, we do have that invitation out to Mr. Carollo. Love to have him anytime. Carlos Frias, Miami Herald food editor. Carlos, always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
All right, Louis, cuídate.
All right. And we're going to stay on this story. And of course, we'd love to hear from any of the businesses there on Calle Ocho. Let us know, you know, when Ball and Chain comes back, if the business comes back and you get busy again, hopefully so. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, October 27th. Coming up tomorrow, local elections are coming up next week. Don't forget, for some of the South Florida's biggest cities, we're going to talk about what you should know about those elections and the early voting turnout numbers. Not looking good, but there's still time to vote if you haven't. Plus, it's Halloween, for heaven's sakes. So how can we not talk about something spooky? Let's talk about, like, spooky places in South Florida. One of the famous ones, the Biltmore Hotel. Let's talk about how spooky that place is. I don't know if anybody's ever been there and seen a ghost, but I keep hearing stories. I haven't seen anything yet. Also, we'll talk about the Miami Dolphins. Why? Because they're our team and we have to. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.